Strange Shadows, a Clark Ashton Smith podcast.
Out of the fiery furnace of the desert sunset, he came to meet our caravan. He and his camel were a single silhouette of shadow-like thinness that emerged above the golden-crested dunes and disappeared by turns in their twilight-gathering hollows. When he descended the last dune and drew near, we had paused for the night. We were pitching our black tents and lighting our little fires. The man and his dromedary were like mummies that could find no repose in the subterraneans of death. That had wandered abroad beneath the goading of a cryptid spur ever since the first division of the desert from the town. The face of the man was withered and blackened as by the torrefaction of a thousand flames. His beard was as grey as ashes, and his eyes were as expiring embers. His clothing was like tatters of the ancient dead, like the spoils of ghoulish ragpickers. His camel was mangy, moth-eaten skeleton, such as might bear the souls of the damned on their dolorous ride to the realm of Iblis.
Greetings, friends, and welcome to Season 2, Episode 3 of Strange Shadows, where we're working through the weird fiction of Clark Ashton Smith, story by story. The voice you just heard was author Alexandra Beaumont, reading the first paragraph from the first of two stories we're covering today. I'm one of your hosts, Rob Poyton.
And I'm the other one, Tim Mendes. Yep, we're covering two stories, Told in the Desert and The Willow Landscape, which are both quite short, but as always with Smith, there's quite a lot packed into them, isn't there?
Oh, yeah, there's some really nice descriptions in both of these stories, actually. I enjoyed them both, yeah.
Yeah, very visual. Again, I think them correctly termed prose poems, I think, more so than actual short stories. But, it's that poetic leaning of Smith's comes right to the fore once again.
Yes. Speaking of which, shall we begin with our favourite words? Because the first story I found quite a lot, but not so much in the second story.
Yes, yeah. So, same, I found one in the second story.
So from Told in the Desert, the first one that leapt out at me was torrefaction.
Nice.
Now, I looked up the meaning of this, then had to look up the meaning of that. Well, actually, I found two definitions. One that I could grasp was a method of roasting coffee beans.
Cool.
And the more scientific version was thermal degradation of organic biomass.
Brilliant.
Yes, that's what I thought. So we're going to stick with roasting coffee beans. Basically, I'm thinking of it as dehydration.
Yeah.
Or that kind of process.
Funnily enough, the first one I've got, I also had to look up twice because of the same reason, which is, oh God, I'm going to struggle saying this. It's one of those. Orifigiate, which is adorned with ophrae, was the definition. So then I had to look up ophrae. It's a type of embroidery.
Oh, right. Ophrae. I've not heard of that before.
No. So they're two words for the price of one.
Yeah, yeah. And then we had a couple of terms that I was sort of familiar with. One was Iblis, which is from the Quran, and that's basically the Islamic version of Satan or Shaitan.
Yep.
And next to that was Afrit, which is a type of jinn, an evil spirit. Or it means someone who's afraid in Newcastle.
Afrit. My eye man, he's Afrit. Yeah, yeah.
Is that right? I'm Rita Fritt.
Yeah. Nice. Yeah. The final one I got is Olibanum, which is basically another word for frankincense.
Ah, right. Yeah, that fits in with I had Naker, which I think describes the inside of a dome covered in Naker, which is mother of pearl, basically.
Yeah.
And then the last one I had to look up was Ghazals. I'm not sure how to pronounce that, which is basically an Arabic ode or poem, a form of poem.
Cool. And the one I got from The Willow Landscape was Morbid Resia, which is a Renaissance artistic concept based around flesh tones. It can also mean soft, weak, or effeminate.
Ah, right. So another dual meaning word.
Yeah.
We had that last time with, was it Etiolated, I think, wasn't it?
Yeah, Etiolated.
So, what sort of publication history do we have for these two? Is it as tumultuous and prolonged as normal?
Yes, frankly. Yeah. Told in the Desert was originally titled Neria, and it was conceived in 1929 when Smith wrote a full synopsis, but then he sort of went on to do other stuff and didn't get round to it until about a year later, when he completed it in late August 1930. From there, it appears that he did nothing with it. He didn't try and get it published or anything like that until 1950, when he sent it to August Derleth along with two other stories. This was when we covered this in, I believe it was the first time we looked at the letters. This was when Smith was in a state of pecuniary depletion. And Mr. Derleth was doing his best to get him some coin, basically.
Get him some money.
Yeah. And so he said, send me anything you've got that unpublished or whatever, and I'll see what I can do, because people are asking me for your stories. And that's what Smith did. Weird Tales took the other two stories, Metamorphosis of the World and An Offering to the Moon, but rejected Told in the Desert. Smith himself wasn't a fan of it. He called it lengthy and rather uneven.
Oh, right. Okay.
It was finally published by August Derleth in 1964 in the Arkham House collection Over the Edge. Right, yeah, and the Willow landscape is equally fraught, probably more so, actually. It was completed in September the 8th, 1930, and immediately rejected by Farnsworth Wright, who wrote, "It does not seem exactly suited to Weird Tales, and it lacks the swift action that we want for Oriental stories."
Right, so we're back to that idea of not enough action, too much description, the common theme.
Yeah, exactly. But apparently this angered HPL somewhat, and I believe you've got a letter.
Yes, this is from HPL, dated the 17th of October 1930. I think we have read this return address out before, but I'm going to repeat it again, because any opportunity to read this kind of stuff works for me. So this is from the Temple of Azathoth, that which gibbers mindlessly in darkness at the centre of ultimate chaos, hour of the thin piping of the demon flutes in the year of Ngar. Dear Clark Ashton, it is like right to reject the Willow landscape. The damn fool. Action. Hell, what a standard. And yet I know that it is the god of the herd. I hope that the co-editorship of Everil Worrell, whose canal showed a genuine comprehension of the principles of weirdness, will cause some slight improvement in the magazine's principles of selection. He then goes on to say, so it's talking about another story that Smith has sent in, Medusa. If Wright doesn't snap that up, he's absolutely out of his head. As for Wright's policy, he has stated that his index to popular whim is almost exclusively the flood of semi-illiterate airy mail which pours in upon him. Where he may err is in estimating the basic kinship of some new tale to some supposedly analogous tale which the rabble have praised. So obviously what he's saying there is Wright's sort of gauge or barometer for what should go in a magazine, the letters he gets in, which I suppose to some extent is fair enough. But then there's also that thing of people who like things tend not to say anything, and it's the complainers, it's the squeaky wheel that gets the grease, isn't it? You know,
absolutely. I mean, that's more prevalent now than it ever has been, I think. It's always that vocal minority, isn't it? Especially on Twitter.
Yes.
It's like whenever anything gets announced, a new TV show, a new film, anything, there's always, you know, I'm half convinced it's the same people, that this little sect somewhere that just sit there in a cave with a bunch of laptops going, I hate this, you know.
That's like the new Bond villain lair. They're not building nuclear missiles anymore. They're all on social media.
Yeah, they're all on Twitter. Yeah,
it's probably more true to that than we think. But I did like this this quote of Lovecraft, or this line, "Action, hell, what a standard, and yet I know that is the god of the herd." Which, when we think about modern film or anything, it's right, you know, big, shiny, fast action, lots of colours, lots of noise. Yeah. Aren't we on, what's the car franchise series?
Fast and the Furious?
Yeah. What are we on? Fast and Furious 15 or something?
Something like that, yeah. And that's not counting the spin-offs, like Tokyo Drift and all that other stuff.
Yeah.
I think I've seen a grand total of one of them.
That's one more than me. Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, we can talk about, you know, snobbishness, I suppose, or something like that, but you can't help but feel a bit of sympathy for them in that case, can you?
Oh, yeah, absolutely, yeah. Well, after this twin rejection, Smith subbed it to Ghost Stories, where it was also rejected, but he did receive praise for it from the editor, who said it was charming and poetic, but it just unfortunately wasn't a fit for the publication, which is, that's fair enough, I think. I mean, that's a standard thing that authors get. I mean, I've had that more than anything else. That's what, it's like, yeah, it was good, but why did you send it to me?
Yeah, if it's not a fit, it's not a fit. Yeah,
exactly. It was eventually picked up by Philippine Magazine, which was a publication out of California that was originally called the Philippine Education Magazine and was aimed at teachers. In 1924, it was taken over by A.V.H. Hartendorp and became focused on Philippine and world news, along with short stories and poems. Smith remarked in a letter to August Derleth that the rates are nothing very gaudy, but the editor seems to be appreciative.
Right. Right. So if you can't get money, at least get appreciation for your work.
Yeah. Exactly. It was published in the May 1931 issue with a charming illustration by a Philippine artist. The Willow Landscape was later performed by Brother Theodore. Theodore Gottlieb.
Brother Theodore. Now, I don't know too much about that guy, but he was kind of some quite genuinely eccentric character, wasn't he? Yeah. Performer.
Yeah, he was a German actor / performance artist. Yeah, he is a bit of an odd character, but he performed The Willow Landscape on his 1959 LP, Coral Records Presents Theodore in Stereo, which is a snappy title.
Nice.
Now, I had a bit of a dig before we came on, and I found it on YouTube. We will include the link in the notes, so you can go and have a listen. It's something else, I'll tell you.
Is it up there with Mark Smith from The Fall reading Lovecraft?
Oh, yeah, it's on a par. It's on a par, yeah.
Brilliant. So, Told in the Desert, as we've heard, starts with this man and his camel sort of appearing out of the desert like an apparition. And we get this lovely description of him, that they're both, not just a man, but they're both like mummies that could find no repose in the subterranes of death. So it's almost like this guy has come out of a pyramid. And I suppose we learn as we go through that he does seem almost ageless. There's a hint of the sort of the Flying Dutchman or the Wandering Jew kind of myth in this, perhaps.
Yeah, that there is that sort of trope, isn't there, of the ageless nomad that wanders the desert. I mean, it's similar to what people like Lovecraft used for Nyarlathotep, really. And obviously, yeah. Bloch took the reins on that as well. So I think that is a common trope in those kind of desert set stories, this sort of ageless and deathless guy cursed to wander the desert sands. It's quite romantic in a weird kind of way, isn't it?
I've got that sort of music playing in my head, you know.
Doo-doo-doo. Oh, an oud.
That kind of sound.
Yeah.
I always thought an oud was a Yorkshire instrument. Sounds like it should be.
A squid-faced monster from Doctor Who that looks a bit like Cthulhu in a suit. Yeah.
There you go. We're always drawing connections.
Indeed.
And I love this description we get of the guy. When you get descriptions like that, who needs action?
This is it. And it's like, I've got two band names out of that passage. We've got The Dolorous Ride.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. And the Ghoulish Rag Pickers.
The Ghoulish Rag Pickers, that's the backing band, isn't it?
Isn't it? Yeah.
But this man is not undead, or is not a mummy, or some sort of revenant, at least as far as we know, because, well, they invite him in and share their meal with him. He sits down and eats with them.
Yeah, a meal of dates and coffee and dried goat flesh. Yeah. I do like a bit of goat. Yeah. It's something you only really appreciate if you've lived in the West Midlands and had proper Caribbean curry goat.
Ah, right.
Never to be pronounced goat curry. It's curry goat.
Oh, yes, of course, curry goat. Yeah, like cheese and bun. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And once they've eaten, again, it's very evocative. In a few words, Smith really paints this picture, doesn't he?
Yeah.
They sit in a circle beneath the crowding stars, and he told us his tale in a voice that had somehow taken on the loneliness, the eerie quavers, and disconsolate overtones of the desert winds. You know, again, that music is playing. You can very easily picture the scene, and the man starts to tell them his story.
Mm.
And we learn that he is old. He is very old. He's so old, his memories of his past grow dim. And if you went to the place that he was born and used to live, no one would remember him. No one would know his name. Though he was once a poet, and like other poets in their prime, I sang of vernal roses and autumnal rose leaves, of the breasts of dead queens and the mouths of living cupbearers. So there's that little hint of the necromancer, if we can put it that way already. The breasts of dead queens. There's another band.
Yeah, there was... Yeah, breasts of dead queens. Yeah. Now, that's an album title, I think. Yeah. Yeah, no, I picked up on that like towards the end of the story, that there's a bit of a sort of necrophiliac undertone to it, you know, which you see in a lot of Smith's stuff. It's that poetic thing again, isn't it? You know, lost loves and passions died and all this.
It's very much lost loves, and it's that romantic stroke gothic ideal of the true love is the one that's gone.
Yeah.
And is no longer within reach, and will always remain that elusive, perfect lover.
Yeah, I wonder with this, because he's saying, though none will remember my songs, and he's talking about like himself as a poet. I wonder again if this is Smith being autobiographical to a degree.
Yeah.
You know, because by this point, his poetic career was pretty much done, because that was an earlier phase in his life. As we've discussed before, Smith is one of them guys that sort of went, now I'm a poet, right, I'm done with that, now I'm a fiction writer, now I'm done with that, now I'm a sculptor. So I wonder if this is him sort of looking back wistfully almost on his poetic career.
Yeah, and it's not the first main character we've had who is a poet either, is it, who seeks to escape from their present circumstances in search of something greater.
Mm.
Or just even in search of that artistic appreciation,
yeah,
we mentioned earlier. So he leaves the city of his boyhood and joins a gallant and merry caravan, which set forth in the month of the flowering of almonds. Again, there's the poetry, right? You could have just said April. When's your birthday? Oh, it's the fifth day of the month of the flowering of almonds. I'm going to use that from now on.
Yeah.
I probably won't get many birthday cards, but
yeah. Mine's in January, so what would it mean? The month of the freezing cold wind.
And this seems like a sort of jolly company he's travelling with. It almost reminded me of sort of Pardoner's Tale thing. Again, it's very easy to picture this band singing as they go along and camping out under the stars at night. Telling tales, swapping stories, swapping odes and poems.
Yeah.
And some of the stories that are told are of a far-off glamorous city, which is where they're supposed to be heading to. So, again, this is a common trope. And I mean, Lovecraft used, we've got the idea of the hidden city, right, in the desert, the city of Irem and all these kind of things. That Shangri-La.
Yeah.
Which I suppose he finds in a way, but not in the form of a city. But again, in common with a lot of Smith stories, we get this idyllic scene. Quite often it's a lovely verdant forest, isn't it, with birdsong. Here we've got a merry company, and things suddenly take a turn for the worse.
Yeah, we got this greening of paradisal trees and minarets of nacre beyond waters of jade, and then bang. Yeah.
They get attacked by the fierce tribesmen of the desert in a deep valley between the hills. And this attack, I suppose this is an action scene, but it's a very brief action scene. But he doesn't really hold back here in some respects, does he?
No.
Because he mentions how they hamstring the camels with their overnumbering spears, which from a tactical point of view makes perfect sense. You want to stop people escaping, you nobble their mounts. But obviously is a really horrible thing to think about.
Well, it was the classic military tactic of shoot at the horses, wasn't it?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. So the caravan basically gets wiped out and our narrator is left for dead, left to the gear eagles of the sand. And he's wounded. He manages to staunch his streaming wound with the tatters of his torn raiment. And seeing that everyone else is dead, there's nothing else really to do but get up and stagger off.
Yeah, I love this line just because it just, I don't know why, it just makes me chuckle to myself a little bit. I left them and tottered away. It's the use of tottered. Just is,
tottered.
Because, yeah. You know, tottering along, you think of a little old lady with like a crochet bag and tottering along on the way to church, don't you?
Yeah. I think of a drunk guy who sort of totters home from the pub.
Oh, yeah.
That sort of diagonal walk.
Yeah. The dressage drunk. Yeah. Yeah, drunken dressage. Yeah.
But he does find a camel that survived as well, even though it's wounded. So at least he's got transport. And then we get, I suppose, what is quite a common trope in any desert story. We get the journey through the desert with no food and no water.
At least he didn't have to resort to eating turds like the chap in that in that Frank Belknap Long story we covered recently.
The red demons of thirst assailed me, and fever came and delirium to people the waste with phantasmagoric shadows. And I fled through eons from the frightful immemorial things that held lordship of the desert and would have proffered me the green beguiling cups of an awful madness with their bone-white hands. And though I fled, they dogged me always, and I heard them gibbering all around me in the air that had turned to blood-red flame. So again, there's no action as such, but that's an action-packed paragraph to me.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. And again, it's that madness, you know, of the people going mad through starvation and dehydration and all the rest of it is brilliantly done. And he goes on, he carries on here, doesn't he? There were mirages on the waste. There were lucent mirrors and palms of fretted beryl that hovered always at an unattainable distance. I saw them in the interludes of my delirium, and one there was at length, which appeared greener and fairer than the rest. But I deemed it also an illusion.
So you got this idea of you're not sure what's real and what isn't. Is it live or is it Memorex? But I also thought with that earlier thing, is that hallucination or is he actually seeing these beings that are there? Does being, you know, people in spiritual methods will fast.
Yes.
In order to purify themselves, in order to, I suppose you're detaching yourself somewhat from the physical, from the corporeal, to commune with whatever you want to commune with.
Yeah.
So is it that the desert is a very old place and there are these things that live there and lurk there, and he gets a glimpse beyond the veil?
Yeah, that's very interesting, because people who are close to death, they, you know, these out-of-body experiences and all that kind of stuff. I'm always reminded of a Billy Connolly quote. He's talking about, you know, fasting 40 days and 40 nights in the desert and seeing God sort of thing. And he says, you try it. You fast for 40 days and 40 nights. You'll be talking to Elvis.
Yeah, so there's a big conversation to be had there about, well, all sorts you can get into, mushrooms and ergo and all sorts of things and visions.
Yep.
Again, and I know that's something in some religious practices that is very much guarded against. What you're seeing, is it real or is it an actual spiritual experience? You know,
yeah.
But that's a whole other big subject.
Oh, yeah.
But I thought it was interesting that he makes that a little bit... It's not obvious that it's unreal.
It's classic unreliable narrator stuff, isn't it? It's really well done. And I can't help but draw comparisons to Niall Athetep.
Yes.
In these descriptions. Whether that was a conscious thing, I don't know when Lovecraft wrote Niall Athetep. But
that was quite early, I think.
It was. Yeah. I'm just thinking because it reminds me of the stuff that Robert Bloch did. So I don't know whether Bloch had already done any of it by this point, or I don't know. But there is parallels there.
It feels like I'm going to invent a word. I think if I can say it, there's a Niall Athetepian presence lingering or looming over all of this, isn't it?
Nice.
That's good.
That's a good
it?
One. A Niall Athetepian. Yeah. I love it. Yeah.
So he sees this mirage and he heads towards it and he passes out oblivion. And when he wakes up, he thinks surely he must have died and is now in paradise because he's laying on soft sward and the waving verdure about me were lovelier than those of earth and the face that leaned above me was that of the youngest and most compassionate houri. But then he sees the wounded camel. So he thinks, I'm not sure that wounded camels get into paradise as well. Perhaps they should. You know, he's done a good job. Oh, and then he feels pain as well. So he thinks, all right, I'm still alive.
Yeah, this lovely houri who had found him lying on the desert's verge sort of takes him back to a hut amongst the palms. And when he wakes up, she brings him the water and fresh dates. And then smiled like a mother as I ate and drank. And uttering little cries of horror and pity, she bound my wound with the soothness of healing balsams. Again, you've got that Smithian hint of Rumpy Pumpy on the horizon, haven't you?
Well, it's the perfect woman again, isn't it? For that particular circumstance.
Yeah.
And we find that her name is Neria, which he deems lovelier and more melodious than the names of the sultanas who are most renowned in song and remotest in time and fable. And she tells him she's lived there from infancy with her parents, but her parents are now dead. And there was none to companion her except the birds that nested and sang in the verdant frondage. Frondage, that's such a good word, isn't it?
Oh, verdant frondage, I'm nicking that. I talk of fronds a lot because I do a lot of like jellyfish and squids and things like that. So, yeah, verdant frondage, I'm nicking that.
But that sounds like it should be some sort of Shakespearean or perhaps if you had Shakespearean Lovecraft, then the lead actor would be Verdant Frondage, I think. I'm Verdant Frondage. You may remember me from such films as When Madness Strikes.
Interestingly, there is an anthology called Shakespeare versus Cthulhu, which I have.
Yes,
actually very good. It's actually got people like Adrian Tchaikovsky in it. So it's quite a big one, but yeah, it's really good fun. Hey, Nonny Nonny, is that the squid-faced demon? You know,
I do hear tell that there's an anthology coming out very shortly that is Lovecraft in a Dickensian setting.
I believe so. Yeah.
Yes, the Pickman Papers. We should be looking forward to that. But anyway. So basically, he's fallen in love with her straight away. She falls in love with him. And they drift into this idyllic existence where it's just the two of them in this verdant paradise in the midst of the desert. Mm-hmm. And I thought what was interesting with this character was, you know, you have this idea of... The sort of maiden and the crone and the young, or the maiden, the mother, the crone. You seem to get this in one woman here because he describes her as like innocent grace and childlike beauty.
Yep.
He describes the maternal tenderness, but there's also this feeling that she's probably a lot older than might appear.
Yeah. That's interesting. That's an interesting thought. I haven't picked up on that. But yeah, you're right, because he does sort of describe her in those three terms, which you've got to think with his poetic background, that's got to be a conscious thing,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, it's the three aspects of womanhood, I think it's sometimes called, yeah. Isn't it? Or the goddess, three aspects of the goddess. Yeah.
The goddess, yeah.
And I suppose we do have to bear in mind, as you said, unreliable narrator, so... Who knows? I mean, that's something we can talk about at the end, perhaps. But, we felt no needs, no hungers, other than those which were amply satisfied by the crystal well water, by the purple fruit of the trees, and by each other. Oh. So there we've got our three main appetites taken care of.
Classic Clark Ashton Smith fruitiness.
But as always, once again, into this perfect situation, there comes a small note of discord, and that note grows louder and louder. And he even describes it as, ours was the divine monotony of contentment.
Nice, isn't it? Ours was a slumber enchanted by cloudless stars and caresses without denial or regret. Yeah, see, you get this feeling of, it's one of those, you be careful what you wish for kind of thing. It's like you get it. I think it's that trope, isn't it, that the chase is better than the catch.
Yes, and the grass is always greener and that kind of thing. Yeah, absolutely.
That's it. Yeah.
Because, alas for the tiny whisper of discontent that awakens sooner or later in the bosoms of the blessed, that is heard through the central melodies of heaven. And I do like this idea of that slight note. I mean, this is Tolkien-esque in a way, because Tolkien's whole creation myth was set around music. You know, the world is created through music, and the evil comes through that little discordant note that comes in somewhere and then gradually grows into this dissonance. So, well, to put it bluntly, he gets bored.
Yeah, and he starts he starts thinking about past loves sort of thing, doesn't he? I had sought in former time, and the voices of fame, the tones of sultana-like women besought me with far seductive murmurs. So yeah, it's that classic trope of the guy who gets married and wishes he was single again so he could go out shagging. It's basically what you're saying, isn't it?
Yes, in poetic terms.
In very poetic terms, but that's the gist of it, right?
That's it. That's exactly it. And Neria obviously realizes what's happening, and this makes her sad. And she watches me with eyes that are darkened like nocturnal wells, in which there lingers a single star. Again, a very evocative and poignant image.
Mm.
So he decides he's going to leave. He's going to depart. Urgent duties call me and could not be denied. This is like I've got to go because I left the oven on. So, you know, I would love to stay the night, but I've got to be up early for work in the morning.
Yeah.
And all she says is, go not, I pray thee, for if thou goest, thou shalt not find me again.
I love this next line. I laughed at her words and kissed her, but her lips were as cold as those of the dead.
Mm.
Nice.
So he does. He leaves. Of that which followed, there is much and yet little to tell. After many days among the veering boundaries of the sand, I came to a far city, and there I abode for a while, and found in a measure the glory and delight of which I had dreamed. So presumably, or I'm guessing this could be the city that the caravan was aiming for, and it lives up to its reputation, the descriptions. Yet, amidst all the noise and the clamouring bazaars and the silken whisper of harems, there returned to me the parting words of Neria. So is back where he wants to be, but he also wants to be back where he was. It's this dilemma again, isn't it, of wanting everything, I guess.
Yeah, he wants to have his cake and eat it, you know. It's that classic thing, isn't it?
After a time he returns to the desert. I retrace my way with exceeding care by the dunes and remotely scattered wells that mark the route. But when I thought to have reached the oasis and to see again the softly waving palms above Neria's abode and the glimmering waters beside it, I saw no more than a stretch of featureless sand where a lonely futile wind was writing and erasing its aimless furrows. That's a very nice line as well, the idea of writing something, but then it's immediately being erased and rubbed out by the same thing. A totally sort of pointless and futile exercise.
Yeah. Could also have another band name there, maybe a side project of the Wurzels, Aimless Furrows.
The Wurzels. I tell you, it is a superpower we've got, never mind our bad pronunciation and all the rest of it. It's for taking Smith's poetic language and bringing it crashing back down to earth. No one does it like us.
Yeah, I know. Funnily enough, a friend of mine at one of the at the Eastercom recently, he's one of the trainers, he's coming to the Innsmouth Literary Festival, and he turns around, I'd said something in one of the panels, he goes, "I've decided your superpower is turning anything into a double entendre."
Absolutely.
You're not wrong.
So that's basically the story. And it's not even that you can't find the place. When he looks around, the wells that he finds are brackish with desolation and could never have held the crystalline sweetness of the well from which I had drunk with her. So it sounds to me like he's in the right place physically, but it's not the same time or space or dimension or something.
Yeah, or spiritually maybe.
Mm.
It's interesting. It's a very interesting ending, I think. Because this is what we're talking about, the unreliable narrator. It's almost as if those years are a fever dream. You know, was it a fever dream brought on by his delirium in the desert and then he finally reached the place and sort of came to his senses?
Yeah.
Or did it really happen? You know, it's left ambiguous, which I think is one of Smith's greatest sort of mechanics in his stories.
But the power of it, whether it was a real or a dream, or whether he slipped into almost like a sort of fairyland kind of setting, you know, the power of it is such that he spent the rest of his life searching for this place still. So that's where we get the wanderer in the desert, and obviously being in the desert has altered him physically and mentally. And he talks about the tortures and despairs and delusions of the quested miles, the waste whereon there falls no lightest shadow of any leaf, and the wells whose taste is fire and madness.
It reminds me a little bit of A Night in Malnion.
Yes.
You know, that almost liminal space thing going on.
Absolutely, absolutely. So that's his story. We were all silent when the stranger ceased, and no one cared to speak. But among us all there was none who had not remembered the face of her to whom he would return when the caravan had ended its wayfaring. So that's a nice touch. It reminds all the people there of their own loved ones or families at home to whom they're returning.
Yeah.
And against that is that sense of, I suppose, nostalgia in a way, but also of belonging to somewhere. And that's what I need to get back to.
Yeah, it's that classic homesickness and loneliness of the wanderer thing, isn't it? It's the loneliness of the long distance runner. Yeah. So all that kind of stuff.
Well, the long distance camel rider.
Indeed, indeed. Interestingly, considering what I just said a minute ago, one of the last sentences here basically says pretty much what I just said. And far off in the ghostly light, a doubtful shadow passed from June to June like a fever dream phantom.
Mm.
So there you go.
And it seemed to us that the shadow was the single silhouette of a camel and its rider.
Yeah.
So even at the end, it's ambiguous as to, was this guy even real, or was he some sort of phantom out of the desert?
That's it. I mean, it could be unreliable narrators within unreliable narrators. We don't know how long these other chaps have been out in the desert, and you know.
Well, you do get the occasional ghost story. I heard one firsthand from a friend of mine years back when he was in the RAF about picking up a hitchhiker, and then there's no. Yeah. I think it was on the back of his bike. As he was heading into a RAF base, and when he got there, you know, there's no one on the back of the bike kind of thing. That's a not unusual story in that sense.
Yeah, it's that sleep deprivation, but basically all your senses are deprived, you know. And I think you think it's your subconscious kind of looking for something to hold on to stop yourself drifting even more into lunacy.
Yeah,
I think, you know.
Or there is that state, you're not in full sleep, but you're in that sort of highly susceptible dream state where you can imagine things. I mean, we've all had dreams, right, where you wake up and for a minute you think, oh my God, the shark bit my leg off, you know, and you're sort of flexing your toes. Oh, no, it's okay, they're still there. But for that second, that experience was totally real.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And so my partner suffers with the sleep paralysis.
Right.
And obviously, she makes a noise like a hooting owl when it happens.
I'm sure she'll love you sharing that with
No, it's just funny,
the
but yeah, but but when it wakes me up, right, some of the stuff, because she's still in the dream state, and like talk to me about car aerials or something. I'm like, why are
world.
you talking to me about it at like 4 in the morning? What's going on?
Yeah, so I mean, I think that's almost a perfect weird tale. I know it's not, there's no monsters in it, there's no monstrosities or fights or action, but I don't think it's diminished in any way by that, because for me, the action in that is what he's seeing and what he's in is experiencing. And it's very evocative, and as we said, it's so richly drawn, you can visualize it, you can almost feel the heat of the sun.
And I often find that the phantoms of the mind and the subconscious are the most effective, really. I mean, that's sort of like one of my favorite stories, The Willows. I mean, you don't see anything tangible, really. It's all in the mind, and there is that sort of sense in it up until like the last third, where you don't know whether anything is happening or whether it's just in the head of these two guys who are stranded in the middle of a river. And you get that same sort of quality in a lot of Smith's work.
And I think in M.R. James as well. I mean, I know in some stories you get the very tangible creature or demon or whatever, but there's also those stories where only one person has this experience, and he'd just woken up and he saw, or he was in that sort of fugue state or heightened state in some way. So there's always that slight uncertainty again about, is that a real experience or is it all imagined?
Now, a view from a hill is probably a good example of that, because that all could all just be in the guy's head.
Well, even Whistle and I'll Come to You. Especially the adaptation with Michael Horden, that very much seems to be going on in his head.
That's a brilliant adaptation. Wasn't a huge fan of the John Hurt one, but.
Oh, no, less said the better. So, The Willow Landscape is our second story for today. Also, quite a short story, but also very rich in language and description.
Yeah, I think this is one of the shortest ones we've covered, isn't it? It's only about 4.5 pages long.
And we're not in the desert for this one. We seem to be in the Orient, or well, China, we imagine. There's no real description of the time or the setting as such, but the main focus of the story is a picture. The picture is more than 500 years old, and time had not changed its colours unless to touch them with the mellow softness of ancient hours, with the gathering morbidezza of bygone things. So already in the first line, we've got this really evocative description, the mellow softness of ancient hours. That's beautiful.
Yeah, and as we discovered, morbidezza, or however you pronounce it, is basically, pigments of flesh tones. And again, you've also already got that sort of morbid quality, haven't you?
So the painting is on silk by a great artist of the Song Dynasty. So I guess we can date it from that 500 years after the Song Dynasty. Unfortunately, my Chinese history is not up to it's not up to much. I'm not sure if we're in Ming Dynasty there, but anyway, for 12 generations, it had been one of the most cherished possessions of the forefathers of Shi Lang, and it was equally cherished by Shi Lang himself, who, like all his ancestors, was a scholar, a poet, and a lover of both art and nature. So once again, we have another central character who's, well, a poet, an artist, someone who appreciates culture.
Yeah, it's another cipher I'm getting, I get.
And this is a person who prizes quiet and solitude. And often in his dreamiest or most meditative moods, he would unroll the painting and gaze upon its idyllic loveliness with a feeling of one who retires to the seclusion and remoteness of a mounted, walled valley. So, even though he's in the imperial court, he's an official at the court and it's very busy and bustling, his solitude comes from looking at this picture, and I guess he's imagining himself in that scene.
I think everybody's had an experience like that at some point. I mean, I remember in my youth, when I first got Black Sabbath's first album, and looking at that cover, And you sort of imagine yourself by that lake, by that old steel mill sort of thing. And
yes.
Yeah. You know, and then you've got the lyrics of the song, you know, with eyes of fire and all that. It's incredibly haunting. And I think everybody does that to a degree. That's why them old album sleeves were brilliant. And covers on books as well. So we've talked before how important cover art is. And I mean, this is just a great example of that, isn't it?
And it's a shame that for music, that seems to become a lost art. I mean, I know vinyl was made a comeback to some extent.
Yeah.
But that was, there was an experience to getting an album, maybe being on your own or being with friends. You take it out the sleeve, you put it on the record player. It's almost like a ritual. You've got the lyrics on the sleeve, you've got artwork on the album. If it's gatefold, then you open it up and, you know, it all adds, it was a complete experience, not just a case of I'll press a button, listen to some music for 10 seconds, then skip to the next one, you know?
Yeah. I mean, even CD to a degree had some great booklets. The bands that actually put in the extra effort got some really good like art booklets and things like that that went with them. But that sort of phased out quite quickly, didn't it? And then you ended up with just like the little jewel case with a single piece of paper in it with like it's just.
Yes, you know. And now you don't even get that. You just download something, and it's one of 300 songs on your MP3 player or whatever, you know. Yes, I can't help but feeling we've lost something there a little bit.
Yeah, same. Absolutely.
So the picture, as you might expect, represents a pastoral scene of the most ideal and visionary beauty. In the background arose lofty mountains, rendered vague by the slow withdrawal of the morning mists. In the foreground there ran a little stream, descending in mimic turbulence to a tranquil lake and crossed on its way by a rustic bridge of bamboo. So anyone who knows Chinese landscape paintings, particularly from that time, will say this is very typical of its type. They typically depicted mountains. Mountains in China, well there's five mountains called the Sacred Mountains. So these were where the temples would be placed. The most famous would be like Shaolin Temple. Wudang Mountain had the Taoist temples on it. It was where, I suppose, they were quite remote areas and obviously very secluded. So ideal for the monastic lifestyle.
Yeah, and you also get that, you get reference to willows of vernal green, which it goes on to say that they were like the willows of the Shaoshan, the Taoist paradise. Yes, these willows are kind of... They're almost like a totem, aren't they? They're sort of like, you know, intrinsically linked with spirituality, the willows out there.
Yeah. Yeah, it's long life, it's longevity, which again goes into the Taoist beliefs in particular, because a lot of the Taoist hermits would quest for immortality. Now, however you define immortality is another thing, but basically that's why they would withdraw from society, you know. But we do get a figure in this as well. Partly hidden among them was a tiny hut, and a maiden dressed in peony pink and white was crossing the little bamboo bridge. But somehow the picture was more than a painting, was more than a veritable scene. It possessed the enchantment of far-off things for which the heart has longed in vain, of years and of places that are lost beyond recall. So again, very much the same idea as the last story. We had this paradisical moment or place or experience or time in our life, and now that's gone. We can only look back wistfully.
Another common thing in a lot of Smith's stories you see cropping up here again is that monomania coming again. It becomes an obsession, doesn't it, of sitting there and sort of staring at this painting. It's a longing, you know. It's life's crap, but the life in the painting is idyllic, sort of thing.
And his life is crap, right? Because he's having money troubles. He's alone apart from his younger brother, a boy of 16 who he has to look after. He's certainly in a state of pecuniary depletion. His family fortunes have declined. He's the inheritor of many debts and little cash or property, except a number of priceless art treasures. His life was increasingly sad and oppressed by ill health and poverty. Again, we can't help but think a little bit of the autobiographical coming in here, right?
Absolutely.
And he loses his job on top of all that.
Make a good blues record, wouldn't it?
So he has to start selling off the family silver, basically, just in order to survive. And what he's actually doing, the money he gets from selling off the family heirlooms, obviously some goes to survive, but he's also paying for his brother's education. Because if his brother passes his exams, then I guess he could get a job at court as well, and, you know, things will start picking up.
Yeah. And, yeah, he takes another blow, doesn't he? Because as he's approaching middle age and his honourable heart was rejoicing over the payment of the last family debt, there came a fresh stroke of misfortune.
Yeah.
Through no fault or remissness of his own, but the machinations of an envious fellow scholar, Shi Lang was suddenly deprived of his position and found himself without means of support. So, yeah, there you go. Like you said, he loses his job, and that's... it's not good, is it?
No. And you can't help but wondering if this machination was to force him to sell these art treasures at it's going to be a knockdown price, isn't it? Because he's forced into a corner, basically.
Yeah.
And this is where the Mandarin Mung Li turns up, a connoisseur. So you can't help but wondering if this guy was somehow behind him getting him losing his position to force the sales. And Mung Li has long coveted this picture. He came in person, his eyes gleaming in his fat face with the avidity of a collector who scents a bargain, and a transaction was soon concluded. So that's the last treasure he's got. He's been forced to sell his beloved painting.
Yeah, it's like classic deception in the antiques and art world, isn't it? I mean, you hear a lot of these stories of the lengths that people will go to drive people into a sale of something that they want. It's big business. It's big business for these people.
And Mung Li's not totally heartless, because she says, look, can I just keep the picture for one more day before I bring it to you? Just one more day of looking at it. And Mung knows that this guy is an honourable man, so he says, yeah, that's fine. So Shi Lang is then left alone to unroll the landscape, hangs it on the wall, and this is his last chance to look at his picture.
Mm.
And this is where we get something else that happens in Smith quite a lot as well. We get people drawn to a distant planet.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, it's happened on more than one occasion. Almost that one time you feel it, the guy's going through the telescope.
Yeah.
And here we get Shi being drawn into the picture, totally drawn into the picture. And now there happened a strange and inexplicable thing. Though the sun had gone down while Shi Liang continued to gaze and dream, and a twilight had gathered in the room, the picture itself was no less plain and luminous than before, as if it were lit by another sun than that of contemporary time and space. And the landscape had grown even larger, till it seemed to Shi Liang that he was looking through an open door on the veritable scene itself. Then, as bewilderment assailed him, he heard a whisper that was not an actual voice, but which seemed to emanate from the landscape and become audible as a thought in his inmost mind. And it's like the painting is inviting him in.
Mm-hmm.
So that leads us to the end of the story. Shi Lang has disappeared, which was a matter of brief and passing concern to those who had known him. That's not very nice, is it? Brief and passing concern. No.
You'd think his brother at least would, you know, send a search party or something, but no. Nope.
Yeah, it seems to be, oh, is he gone? Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And the general consensus is that his financial sorrows have driven him to suicide, probably thrown himself in the great river that ran athwart the capital.
Again, you see the spectre of Ambrose Bierce there, don't you?
Yes, oh, yes, of course. Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, the mysterious disappearance. And I never thought of that.
Yeah.
So the sale of the last painting was enough to pay for the rest of Po Lung's tuition. So he's happy. The Mandarin Mung Li is happy because he's got the painting that he always wanted. But there's one strange little detail that puzzles him when he unrolls the volume and examines it. And that, of course, is the addition of an extra figure next to the maiden in pink. Mung Li expected the second figure with much curiosity and was more than surprised when he noted that it had a singular resemblance to Shi Lang.
And now we come to the final line, which is... loaded with innuendo.
This is classic Smith, right? This really is.
Meng Li might have thought the matter still stranger if he'd looked more often at the painting. He might have found that the peony maiden and the person who resembled Shi Lang were sometimes engaged in other diversions than that of merely passing the time of day on the bamboo bridge. Oh, matron.
Artistic in painting, rumpy pumpy.
Yeah, brilliant. Classic Smith.
And that's kind of, I was going to say a more romantic person, but that's not really the right term to use. Would have had them holding hands.
Mm.
The couple are holding hands. No.
No. We've stuck in a painting for eternity.
But then I can't help putting those two stories together and then thinking, is Shi Lang at some point going to go, there's that painting of the Mona Lisa. I wouldn't mind going and seeing her. There's a story in that. Has anyone done that? The ability to travel into paintings. I mean, I kind of used the idea in one of my, I think it's in Portraits of Terror, where a painting was used. I won't give the story away. But, imagine if you could drop into Hieronymus Bosch or something.
God. Yeah. Saturn devouring his child or something like that.
Yeah. So there's something, dear listener. What painting, if you had the choice, would you like to jump into and why? Let us know.
They've used the painting thing in a lot of films and things like that. People going into paintings, into pictures, into photographs. The Red Dwarf did it with the time slides, didn't they? That he could travel back in time and and abuse Hitler, you know. Don't listen to him, he's mental and he's only got one testicle. But there's a great big in the Elder Scrolls game, Oblivion, there's a quest where a painter's gone missing and you've got to look for them, and you get the materials and you find the painting and you end up in the painting, and there's these like troll things, but you need to use turpentine on your arrows to kill them. And that reminds me of that for some reason. I'm not entirely sure why, it just does.
I'm sure it must have been used in things, and I'm sure I've seen it in a Call of Cthulhu scenario or something somewhere. Yeah. But so I suppose not an uncommon trope, maybe even for its day, I don't know, but very nicely done. Now, I could see with that one someone saying there's not enough action in it, because that is more of a wistful story, I'd say, and quite nice, quite charming in many ways.
It's a mood piece, isn't it? It's you can see what the guy from Ghost Stories was saying, that it was beautifully written, really poetic, just not really what we're going for, because it's not really a ghost story, is it? But yeah, it's a beautifully well done mood piece.
And again, I think with both of these stories, you could see those as Twilight Zone type adaptations.
Yeah.
They'd fit easily into that format.
Yeah. Night Gallery, specifically the second one.
Yeah.
That would work perfectly, wouldn't it? Why didn't do that? I had no idea.
It is strange as to why a lot of more of these weren't adapted, but then I suppose not that strange. Well, when did you say this was printed? I mean, if it was published in the 50s or something, but then it was in quite an obscure journal. I can't imagine the Philippine being a very widely read journal.
No, 1931, the second one.
So it's been around for a while.
Yeah, but like you say, I mean, the Philippine was, Philippine magazine was pretty much a local publication for the Filipino community.
And I guess that's like a monthly thing or something. So and the old copies would have been thrown out, because who keeps magazines?
Well, interestingly, when I was doing a little bit of digging on Philippine magazine, apparently several of the issues are completely lost. Remaining copies or even facsimiles of them. They're just lost to time.
That's a shame, isn't it, to think of what great stories might have.
I often think that with a lot of these things, these magazines. I think about it a lot with do you remember the fanzines in the 70s and 80s?
Yes,
and
yes.
Early 90s. Because, I mean, I've still got some of them, and you get some great articles in them. I mean, there's a really good, like, look at the tropes in Dracula in this one I've got that was put out by the London Vampire Group in like 1993 or something. Yeah. And it's a really well written article, but I can't imagine it's anywhere else except in this fanzine, you know.
Well, from the Lovecraft perspective, I mean, there was Crypts of Cthulhu and all those things. And here in the UK, we had Dagon fanzine.
We did have Dagon, yeah.
By the late Cole Ford, who we sadly lost a couple of years ago, or maybe two or three years ago now. And again, that started off quite basic in its production, you know, that old, like the school newsletter kind of thing, you know.
Yeah.
But it developed into a really nice looking fanzine as well. I'm not sure. I think I've probably got about 20 issues or something. I'm not sure exactly how long it ran. But there was interviews with Ramsey Campbell. There was people writing for it. There were short stories from a range of people. Brian Lumley. There were scenarios. And to the best of my knowledge, they've not been reprinted anywhere else. So I'm not sure how that would work from a rights point of view, but it would be nice to see some sort of compilation of that put together in a new publication. Actually, that's something I'm going to research and look at. That's going to be
yeah, you should. I mean, yeah, because these things, you know, I guess it'd be getting in touch with whoever held the rights in the first place, you know.
Yeah.
Or the individual. I mean, whether you'd have to contact the individual rights holders, like each story or feature writer.
Yeah.
I'm sure if you sent them an email, they'd probably just go, yeah, do it, whatever.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, because I've had it myself, just like, oh, that anthology you're in like 3 years ago, we want to do a best of our publication thing, can we stick that story in it? We'll give you a fiver. It's just like, yeah, whatever, you know, yeah, do it, I don't care.
The rates haven't changed much, have they?
No, they haven't. I mean, it's all eyes at the end of the day, isn't it? It's
and also, speaking of, you know, I mean, just the sheer amount of work that must be involved in bringing all the Smith stories together. Just a shout out and a tip of the hat again to Scott Connors and Ron Hilger for putting these Nightshade books together.
Yeah, they are superb volumes. It's like, I definitely need to get hold of their Hope Hodgson ones as well, Nightshade, because if they've got the same care, they're going to be something pretty special.
Yes.
Yeah, in the appendices, in the notes, you actually sometimes get a little bit about the work that they put in getting hold of the typescripts of these. And for Told in the Desert, they actually say that no manuscript or typescript survives at either of the estates, and a search of the remaining archives at Arkham House failed to locate the tale, and it was collected posthumously in a Clark Ashton Smith collection from Arkham House, so that's the version that they used.
Right. Yeah. And perhaps one day we should get in touch and invite them on the show. Perhaps they can come on. That'd be a great talk to them about the whole process of getting these stories together. So that's something we'll look into.
It'd be very interesting, because yeah, so I imagine that, like, some of the more obscure ones that we've covered in the past, you know, that like got nicked. Well, that one that got stolen.
Yes.
You know, and then they found it again.
Yeah. Disappeared in New York, didn't it, or something? And then, yeah.
Yes, indeed. Yeah.
Okay, so those are our two stories for this episode. Both excellent stories. I think, again, Smith on top form, even if Farnsworth, Wright and others didn't quite appreciate the so-called lack of action. Now, we've had some action here at the Strange Shadows Towers. Yeah, not that sort. We've not been on a bridge or anything like that.
A bamboo bridge.
By action, I mean we've had some people get in touch with some comments, which we very much appreciate.
Indeed.
And we've had a couple of patrons get in touch. Gary Pennington writes, "Great episode, guys. Love the description of the Butterfly House atmosphere. This is referring to the Red World of Polaris we covered last time. There is a Butterfly House in Leeds, and it does have a uniquely humid atmosphere." I feel like I need to go and visit a Butterfly House or Butterfly Farm now just to.
I love them. I absolutely love them. I've been to loads of them all around the country. There's actually one not far from here that we walked out to last year, because a lot of farms have, to make a bit of extra money, have actually started doing them on their land, but they're brilliant. And like, when you see like some of the huge caterpillars and big knots of these furry you know, spiny things. It's breathtaking. And but yeah, I'm a big fan of them, man. It is a unique smell and atmosphere to them.
And Gary continues, apropos of nothing, I finally got around to watching, and here he gives the YouTube link to the preview for Emperor of Dreams. Finally got around to watching it yesterday and enjoyed it very much. I'm not sure if you've seen it, but it's on sale on Amazon Prime in the UK for £8 and well worth a watch. So Emperor of Dreams is a documentary about Clark Ashton Smith. And yes, I've watched it, and it's compulsive viewing for any Clark Ashton Smith fan. Very well made documentary.
Yeah, I've not actually got round to watching it yet. I have a copy, but I haven't got round to watching it yet. It's like reading. I have a to watch pile that you could scale. You know, you could go mountaineering up it.
And I'm pretty sure that Ron Hilger is in that as well, actually, and maybe Scott Connors. Certainly Harlan Ellison is in there, and various other people.
Yeah.
Who knew Smith or associated with him or are fans. So yeah, excellent viewing.
Yeah, another of our patrons, A.T. Johnson, writes, did anyone catch the C.L. Moore reference Smith made in that last letter you quoted?
I think the short answer to that is no.
Yeah, no, completely flew over my head. We'll have to have a look. We'll have to go back and have a look.
Yes, yeah, we'll talk about that next time. Because I think for us, it's always interesting to see these connections between all these authors as well.
Definitely.
Yeah. So thanks for that, A.T. Johnson. We appreciate both of those messages. And of course, you can always get in touch with us at intimathbookclub@outlook.com. You can leave a message on our Facebook page, or you can leave a message on our Patreon site. And while you're on our Patreon site, please do take a look at our patron offers, where you can sign up at 3 levels of membership. Remember, you get bonus content not only for Strange Shadows, but also for our sister podcast, the Innsmouth Book Club. You also get regular copy of Innsmouth News, which is now quarterly, discount on merchandise, and free entry to events we are putting on, such as the forthcoming Innsmouth Literary Festival, which is happening in September.
Indeed, and we've just had another guest sign up for that. We will be joined by grimdark author Anna Smith-Spark, who's got a new book coming out around that time, which is dark folklore and stuff like that. So she's very welcome, and yeah.
Excellent. Well, that's it for this time. I hope you enjoyed those two stories and listening to our rambling thoughts. I think we've got something of a classic next time coming up.
Oh, we do indeed. Yeah, we do indeed. One of my personal favourites, A Rendezvous in Averoigne.
Yes, classic Smith territory.
Yeah.
I always like the Averoigne setting as well. This is where Smith goes kind of Robert E. Howard direction, with a more supernatural elements as well in those Averoigne stories, I think.
Yeah, I see them as a continuation of the Hyperborean stuff, because they're obviously linked through various bits and pieces, and they are sort of like there's something almost Alexandre Dumas about some of them, isn't there?
That's what I'm thinking. Yeah, that
bit of a swashbuckling thing going on.
Yeah, that kind of atmosphere with the added supernatural layer on top really works well, I think. Yeah. So that's next time. Hope you can join us then. In the meantime, thanks for listening, and it's goodbye from me, Rob Poynton.
And it's goodbye from me, Tim Mendes.